From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. April marks National Child Abuse Prevention Month. We'll explore efforts to identify and prevent child abuse here in Florida, including the State Department of Children and Families' progress in implementing changes in accordance with the child welfare legislation passed by state lawmakers in 2014, plus the role of child protection teams in our own community. And April 20th will mark the five-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico. 11 people died and some 210 million gallons of oil spilled into the Gulf, resulting in the largest man-made environmental disaster in U.S. history. We'll explore ongoing environmental impacts, related research studies, and restoration efforts. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Monday, April 20th will mark the five-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico. A tragedy is responsible for the deaths of 11 people working on the rig and sparked the oil spill, in which an estimated 210 million gallons of oil was released into the Gulf over an 87-day period before that well was capped. The spill has been dubbed the largest man-made environmental disaster in U.S. history. And while many of the visible signs of the spill's impact superficially seem to have dissipated, environmental restoration efforts and research projects aimed at better understanding the impacts of the spill continue. Joining me now for a closer look is Ann Birch. She's the Florida Marine Conservation Director for the Nature Conservancy. Her areas of expertise include ecology, natural and man-made hazard mitigation, and restoration, among others. Ann, great to connect with you again, and welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much. Appreciate the opportunity.
And we're also speaking with Julie Wraithmell. She's Audubon Florida's Director of Wildlife Conservation. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Also with us is Laura Bowie. She's Executive Director of the Gulf of Mexico Alliance, which will soon launch a new Deepwater Horizon Project Tracker online tool. Laura, thanks for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also talking with Dr. Linda Hooper-Bowie. She's a professor and entomologist at Louisiana State University, working within the Department of Environmental Sciences. She specializes in fire ant physiology and ecology. Dr. Hooper-Bowie, when we think about animals' life, you know, being impacted by the spill, our minds would typically turn to, you know, something like waterfowl, fish, or marine mammals. But I was so interested in your study because you're looking at ants. Can you just tell us a little bit about your research?
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me. We know that people don't pay attention to the invertebrates, the ants. And it turns out they're really important indicators of the health of the marsh. They serve as food for the frogs and the birds and the fish that are very important to marsh life. And also our studies have shown that they're very important in indicating the marsh health. And so we can tell, based on what the ants' presence or absence tells us, about what's going to happen in the marsh and potential land loss and losing the protective value and the nursery value of the marsh.
Hmm. And how did this research effort come about for you? Were you already involved in research with ants when the spill occurred? Or was this work you had already been doing that sort of changed when the spill happened? Or was this something you specifically sought out to use, ants as kind of an indicator species?
We had been looking at ants, you know, I've been studying ants for more than 20 years. But my focus in 2008 shifted, well, my focus changed in 2005, but we shifted almost solely toward the coast and to the marsh in 2008 and 2009, because we were very interested in ants as indicators in the coastal dunes and in the marshes, and also we wanted to ask some really basic questions about what are they doing here, how are they surviving, and how can we take those lessons as humans, and so we've learned a lot from the ants. They have a lot to tell us.
And you're looking specifically at marsh sites around a bay that I understand endured some of the heaviest oiling.
Absolutely. We had sites before the Deepwater Horizon explosion set up to examine some of these basic ecological questions. And then we had some predictive knowledge that the oil spill might come in and impact some of those sites. So we were able to go out immediately after the disaster and sample those sites to get what we call benchmark data, so we knew exactly what was happening at the at sites that we were predicting might be affected. And fortunately for us, you know, even though it was a disaster and it was going to affect our already set up experiments, we were able to get, you know, data that we can compare now in the aftermath.
And how long after the spill did it take, or is it taking, for you to start seeing ants, you know, sort of regaining population numbers, again, healthy population numbers, I should say, in these sites that had endured some of the spill's impacts?
So we didn't just look at the ants. We also looked at their food and other things that might affect them. We looked at spiders and other insects. And initially, with all of those creatures except for the ants, we saw in late 2010, we saw a radical reduction. And we then predicted, as scientists like to do, we predicted or hypothesized that they would rebound in the spring of 2011. And we were also kind of curious about how the ants were so resistant to the problems and the pollution. Well, in 2011, what we saw was catastrophic. In the spring of 2011, there was nearly no flies and crickets and spiders in the marshes that were oiled compared to those that were unoiled. And then later in 2011, so more than 14 months after the spill, the population of ants went from a healthy population in the oiled areas to zero. It crashed. And so that told us that, wow, they're really good indicators of the health of the marsh more than a year after this disaster. And so we've been tracking them now. You know, they fly in, they repopulate, they establish their colonies, and then they die off. They've been doing this every year. And in 2014, late last year, we had about a 30% recovery in the ants in the oiled marshes compared to the unoiled marshes that we compare them to. So we're kind of cautiously saying we're starting to see recovery, but we're, you know, of course, we're excited about it. We're starting to see life in some of those oiled areas.
All right. Well, it sounds like so far your findings speak to, you know, both long-term detrimental impacts, but also the resiliency of nature's ability to rebound.
Absolutely. And although we predicted that it would be sooner than it was, and we think we know, you know, why, nature does rebound, and, you know, the plants and the marsh soils will eventually heal themselves. They have lots of ways to detoxify themselves. This just was an unprecedented amount of pollution. And that unprecedented pollution was just such a huge pull. It's just taking a long time. Now, I can't guarantee that my insects are going to, you know, continue to recover. We don't know yet. We're being cautious about that. We'll find out now, between now and July, what's really going to be the story.
Any plans to publish findings following the summer? Or is this going to be on? I'm sorry, go ahead.
We are, we're finishing a publication on the ants specifically, probably in the next 2 weeks or so, and then we have a publication that we're working on. Actually, I have about three or four publications on the insects and spiders' response to the oil pollution. And one of the things why there's been a delay, you know, people might think, wow, 5 years, that's a long time, but one of the things we wanted to do was separate out tropical storms and hurricane effects and storm surge effects from oil effects, and that's taken some very careful teasing out of the data and making sure that what we're saying, what we're hypothesizing, is supported by the data.
All right. As we approach the 5-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig explosion in the Gulf of Mexico that led to the 2010 oil spill, we're taking a closer look at ongoing restoration efforts and research projects aimed at understanding the spill's impacts. You can connect with our guests with your comments and questions. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or follow the live Twitter chat with hashtag GulfCoastLive. And Anne Birch with the Nature Conservancy, let's hear from you now. Your organization will be releasing a new report titled Charting Restoration, and that comes out tomorrow. Tell us generally about the aim of this report. What sort of information are you specifically looking to track?
Yeah, thank you, John. We're really excited about putting this report out. What we did was looked across the Gulf at the restoration efforts to date and where the funding has been prioritized. And what we did was collect reports that analyzed 116 Gulf projects that have received oil spill funds, nearly over $1 billion to date, and identified where their priorities aligned with the reports and plans, the vision plans that have been put out by communities across the Gulf from Texas to Florida. And these are either all Gulf-wide vision plans or very state-specific plans. And we wanted to see where the priorities were in the plans and how they connected to where the funding to date has gone to those priorities. And in general, we see a good alignment with funding going to conservation and habitat restoration, but there are some gaps, and what we wanted to do was just bring to light that there are priorities out there that have been identified by the communities, and that those should really be taken into consideration for future funding to see if they can be aligned with the funding that comes out of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill.
And of these projects, that are being followed in this report, are they all directly related to environmental restoration efforts, or could they be other types of projects that have been approved for or perhaps are already receiving BP-related funding?
Yeah, there's a variety of projects, and we categorize them into natural projects, human or social type projects, and built projects, for instance, piers or fishing piers or things like that. So the natural projects are restoration of habitat or looking at species research. The human and social projects are those that really help communities recover from the spill. And then, again, the more built environment are primarily those that really boost up recreational opportunities throughout the Gulf. So we tried to categorize the projects into very discrete groups, which was difficult because projects can have multiple objectives to them.
Right. I remember seeing one of the primary conclusions in the embargoed copy of the report I was looking at earlier, that there is some disparity. You said there is, for the most part, alignment, but there is some disparity between how funds from oil spill funding is being spent and the broader planning priorities. Where do we see that disparity? Where is it not lining up?
So there is some disparity, for instance, in Florida with the projects that have been identified there. There's some gaps in funding, for instance, for water quality improvement projects. But what we see is that that's mainly driven by the fact that early funding sources focused on restoration of habitats and species and weren't necessarily designed to address water quality projects. And what we're recommending is that as we move forward, as funding becomes available, that these full suite of projects are also considered. There's been a lot of community input, a lot of good thought put into the visioning and the types of projects that communities would like to see happen on the ground in their regions. And we'd just like those to be taken into consideration.
So could this new report be a good tool for people perhaps looking to propose projects for funding to the Restore Council? Or who is this really intended for?
Absolutely. It could be used for that as a guide for future funding. It is intended to for those entities that are responsible for funding projects to take a look at this and consider it when they are looking at putting out, for instance, a request for proposals for projects, that they consider what the community needs are throughout the Gulf and within Florida, is our primary interest here. So, yes, it can be used in a variety of different ways. And we're involved. We've been facilitating watershed planning throughout the panhandle of the Gulf of Florida. And so that is an example of how this report could help continue to inform the watershed planning. We would send this to our stakeholders throughout those watersheds and say, this is where the suite of projects are that you've been identifying, and this is where the funding could likely be going. So maybe we'd want to direct our projects more towards, say, the natural environment category.
Okay. And speaking maybe not to any particular project itself, but you know, the overall priorities and projects that might come later on down the line as they, you know, relate to restoration, do you anticipate that this is going to need to continue, you know, well beyond the availability of Deepwater Horizon-related funds?
Absolutely. You know, the Deepwater Horizon funds has provided an opportunity to really revitalize the Gulf. Unfortunately, you know, at the expense of some lives, which we really send condolences out and continue to send condolences out to those loved ones that have lost loved ones and those who have suffered because of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. But we look at it as the future of revitalizing the Gulf, restoring the Gulf, and that means not just the environment, but the economy and the social fabric of the Gulf. The Gulf communities are so dependent, intricately dependent on the environment, that this is, you know, going beyond just restore. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, we hope. But what it has been is a catalyst for these communities to come together and say, what do we want our future to be? Using restore funds, but really beyond restore. This isn't just about restore. This isn't just about the Deepwater Horizon oil spill money. It's going beyond that and creating a legacy for the Gulf of Mexico.
All right. And Julie Raithmell with Audubon of Florida, let's hear from you now. I know Audubon staff and volunteers here from the Sunshine State were among the first to respond to the spill in 2010 and have been involved in recovery efforts ever since. Tell us a bit more about how Audubon has continued to remain involved in these efforts.
Absolutely. So we were fortunate that Audubon already had a substantial presence on the Gulf Coast with volunteers helping to protect coastal birds, specifically species that were rare and declining already, even without the threat of an oil spill looming. And so when Deepwater Horizon occurred, many of these people were really eager to get engaged. And while BP and the federal government preferred to have the spill response managed by their own staff and contractors, it meant that folks that were concerned were able, through Audubon, to help work at protecting these beach nesting birds with the idea that if we could have a successful year for the birds here in Florida, it would help to offset losses elsewhere in the Gulf. We know from boundary sightings that birds fledged in Florida are seen in the central Gulf and vice versa. The birds don't read maps or see state boundaries. And so looking forward at what Gulf recovery means, it means addressing the threats to these species and making the Gulf whole again, not just to ameliorate the impacts from the oil spill, but from myriad other, you know, threats and insults that have been inflicted on the Gulf in the last 100 years. The exciting thing, I think, about these grassroots bird conservation efforts is that they have been very community-based, and it's provided an opportunity for a lot of us who felt incredible angst and helplessness in the face of the Deepwater Horizon incident to be constructive and productive and contribute to fixing the problem. And the real advantage of engaging citizen scientists in this work is that similarly, because of their sweat equity in conservation, they are educated and eloquent and emboldened when the opportunity arises to advocate for these resources. And it's emerging just how crucial it is for local communities and citizenry to engage in this restore process. As Anne alluded to, there are a lot of different funding streams. There's a lot of different competing interests. And while it's a great opportunity for restoration of the Gulf, there's also an incredible opportunity for projects to work at odds with one another, or simply not be chosen strategically to achieve their greatest benefit for the Gulf. And that's a great role that the public can play in their local counties and communities.
All right, and you are listening to Gulf Coast Live on WGCU. You can join our conversation ahead of the 5-year anniversary of the BP oil spill, actually the rig explosion that started that, where you can call 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org or follow this on Twitter using the hashtag GulfCoastLive. And, Julie, you know, I wonder with these projects that Anne had just talked about and like Laura Bowie with the Gulf of Mexico Alliance is going to tell us about an interactive online tool that also is tracking oil spill restoration projects. Even with all that going on, the most visible signs of the spill, you know, like those great expanses of oil sheen on the surface of the water, those are long gone. Do you worry about public perception regarding the spill? Is there something of a constant battle to, you know, remind people that there's still a long road ahead?
Absolutely. I don't think that we will understand the full effect of the spill on the food web for years to come. And similarly, people also lose track of the fact that in Florida, a lot of the impacts from the oil spill were also related to the spill response. So in the course of monitoring and trying to protect Florida's coasts from the imminent arrival of oil, many of the responders actually did harm to those coastal resources. That's why it's that much more important, I think, for people to be engaged and so they can see what's going on the beaches and on our coasts today. And it's also why we focus on a lot of threats that we can quantify, we can ameliorate, and that's why, you know, right now there are bird stewards on beaches in Southwest Florida working to ensure that threatened species like snowy plovers and leaf terns and black skimmers and American oyster catchers are successfully able to raise their young to adulthood, knowing that we need these populations to be as resilient as possible for them to weather whatever future fallout we may see in the food web as a result of Deepwater Horizon.
Right. And Laura Bowie.
Yeah, this is Anne, and I'd like to just build on what Julie just said and what Dr. Bowie said as well about the invertebrates. Is you had mentioned that nature is resilient and it's recovering, and that's absolutely true. Nature is very resilient, and people are very resilient as well, but both need help, and it's a long-term effort, and monitoring is crucial to continue over the long term and keep that drumbeat going throughout the communities, throughout the agencies and entities that are responsible for helping fund and recover the Gulf, that this is going to be a long-term effort, but it is possible as well. So just want to to have people understand that.
Sure. And Laura Bowie with the Gulf of Mexico Alliance, your organization is a part of this group that's created a new interactive online tool mapping oil spill restoration projects. Tell us a bit about the tool and when it will be available for public use.
Oh, yeah, thank you. So unlike the other guests, and they're on-the-ground projects that are so, so important that we've got to keep those going, this is more of an online tool. Like you said, it's very interactive. It's going to have a comprehensive listing, catalog, if you will, of all projects, restoration, research, and recovery projects that are resulted from the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. It's going to go live on April 20th. You'll be able to find out key project information for each project and then a link over to the actual scientific data associated with those projects. And you'll also be able to see maps of the areas, the footprint of the different particular projects. You'll be able to print out very customized PDF reports and Excel reports if people need to run very customizable searches on the database. It's got over 300 projects in it now. It's any project that has been awarded as a result right now of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill.
And is your tool really intended for just anybody who's curious, or are there any specific populations that you're looking to target with this?
It's very, very user-friendly. It's intended for the public to use it.
Okay.
We're going to have a demonstration webinar, if you will, on just to kind of show all the cool and unique features and the very customizable searches you can make with it, or the very canned reports that are already made in it. That demonstration webinar will be on April 23rd. That's a Thursday at 1 Eastern. And there, the webinar link is posted on our website, gulfofmexicoalliance.org. But so it really is intended for the general public and anybody who wants to just kind of say, hey, you know, what projects have been done in my state? Or, you know, hey, what oyster projects have been done throughout the entire Gulf? Or what research projects have been done on dispersants kind of thing?
Well, interesting. We'll definitely be looking forward to playing around with that tool once that becomes available next week. Thank you.
Great.
And that is, unfortunately, all the time we have for today's show. But thank you so much, Linda, and Julie, and Laura.
Thank you.
Ann Birch is with the Nature Conservancy, and Julie Wraithmill is with Audubon of Florida. Laura Bowie is with the Gulf of Mexico Alliance, and Dr. Hooper Bowie is with the University of Louisiana. There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui and Luke Martin. This is WGCU Fort Myers 90.1 FM, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.